you. The recordings are started and all lines are open. Please go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Hi, this is Aubrey. I'll be chairing the meeting today. Made a slight change to the agenda. One of the things that we weren't doing was reviewing the agenda. And one of the things I started doing in another working group I'm in that seems to be working well is putting in a review of the agenda at every meeting, but putting it in right at the hour or as close to it as possible while people were still drifting in and before we did the roll call, so that if you really wanted to add something or change the agenda, you would be there on the minute. But allowing the chance for people to get in slightly late and be there for the meet. So anyhow, so the first thing on the agenda is review the agenda, and I just sort of explained if people find this an offensive thing to do, you know, it could certainly be changed back to not reviewing the agenda or doing it after the roll call. Then we'll go through the roll call, updates of any statements of interest. Third item is discussion of the updated, detailed work plan that has been updated on the site. And, in fact, it's what's showing in the screen now. If people have any issues with it, make further changes. Otherwise, that's what we'll say we're working on.
Have a good day.
Then the fourth part was the meeting planning for Costa Rica. There's a couple options that need to be weighed, and we need to start moving towards a decision so that Marika can make reservations, et cetera. Then there's the review of the public comments and beginning on the stakeholder group and community statements received, and that discussion goes on until near the end of the meeting, when then we just basically do a confirmation the next meeting, look at what next step, where we're at. Does anybody have any issues or questions about this agenda, any corrections that need to be made to it? No? Okay, so then we'll go with that as an agenda for today. And thank you for putting up with me and my, you know, obsessive need to review agendas at the beginning of meetings. Natalie, can I ask you to do a roll call at this point?
Of course, Avery. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. This is the IRTPC call on the 17th of January, 2012. On the call today, we have Mikey O'Connor, Avery Doria, Alain Béranger, Michaela Nalen, Kevin Erdman, Barbara Knight, Andy Graves, Eric Iriarty, Zahid Jamil, Simena Tebatiger, James Bladell, Rob Golding, and Bob Mountain. From staff, we have Marika Koenigs and myself, Natalie Peregrine. We have apologies from Philip Corwin, Jacob Williams, and Paul Diaz. I would like to remind you all to please state your names before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you, Avery.
Okay, thank you. I think we also have apologies from James.
This is Marika. James is actually on the call, but he's on.
Oh, he is on the call. Oh, okay. Sorry. Oh, yeah, now I see his name there, too. My word. Okay. So then moving to the third item, which is the updated work plan. We went through it last week and discussed it, and I made a couple changes to it based on the discussion, including the second revision of having two 31 Januaries in a month. Removed that. Does anybody have any issues or questions about the agenda as it stands for this next period, taking us up to the face-to-face meeting in Costa Rica? There is a little bit of another update we'll probably do to this in the 7th February meeting in terms of when we start looking at item A and start figuring out how we're going to structure that discussion. May add some more detail to the that discussion if we get there. So does anybody have any issues with that, or leave that as the calendar we'll work to for the next month or so? Okay. Want to ask also at this point before moving on, are people generally comfortable with this way of dealing with a sort of rolling working agenda of getting greater clarification as we move forward, or has anyone sort of been bothered by this way of doing it and wish we were doing it otherwise? I see a check from my partner in co-chairing. Okay, thanks. In which case, and a couple checks from Mikey and from Simonetta. Fantastic. And none of those red marks. Okay, great. So then the next thing, if no one has anything else on there, nope, cool. The next thing is the IRTP Part C meeting planning for Costa Rica. And after the conversation that we had last week, we basically found ourselves with several different options and variations. And James Marika and I discussed it a bit more afterwards in terms of three meetings seemed a lot. How could we combine to two meetings? What were the various options? And then, Marika, you were also looking into what was possible and such. And so I wonder if you'd be willing to sort of, you know, lead us further into this discussion on what, in reality, our options seem to be, and we can take it from there. Is that okay?
That's fine. So this is Marika. So I think we discussed a couple of different meetings that will take place in Costa Rica, and one of them I mentioned actually at the start of the call. It's typical that different working groups provide an update to the GNSO Council on the status of their work, and that's scheduled or tentatively scheduled to take place on Saturday morning. That's open for working group members to attend, but normally it's the chairs that basically provide a short update to the council and allow council members to ask questions that they may have. I think then we discussed as well the options of having meetings throughout the week. One of the meetings that was discussed was to see if it would be possible to meet with the CCNSO Council. I've actually sent a request to my policy colleagues to see whether that would be an option or not, but I haven't heard back from them yet, so I'll follow up on that. And in addition, the working group discussed whether it would be need to have a face-to-face meeting and possibly also a public session. So I think the options that the working group has to look into, and I need to actually check as well with Glenn, because they did have a first meeting on the schedule for Costa Rica, if it's still the case that, you know, public meetings are scheduled for Wednesday morning and Thursday morning, which are the typical workshops slots. So that option would be, you know, does the working group indeed see there's a need for having two separate meetings? So a face-to-face meeting that's just for the working group and, you know, interested parties can attend, but just as observers, and a separate public meeting, which would be more about, you know, presenting the work of the group to the community and, you know, have an opportunity for input or questions and answers. Or alternatively, it could be as well a combination of those two, having a face-to-face meeting and possibly at the end of that session have 30 minutes or you know, whatever time to appropriate for comments or discussions with people that attend the meeting.
Okay. Thank you. And I guess one of the, there was also a possibility of taking different variations as they came up. So I wonder, does anybody have any viewpoint on these? Personally, I think three meetings is a lot. Simonetta.
I'm just wondering if what the main aim is we're having for getting out of this conference, and if one of our main aims is to get further feedback, especially from people who didn't respond in writing, I'm wondering what the best format is to get that feedback and what the best group is to maybe go to, because I remember Marika saying last week, I believe, do you want to maybe seek a conversation with one of the stakeholder groups and try to get on their agenda? I don't know if we should toss that idea completely, and I didn't hear this being repeated here. So I'm just putting it out there as a thought.
Okay, thanks. I guess one possibility would be trying to get various people to go in and get on the stakeholder group and constituency agendas, especially for those who did not send comments, either because, well, it could be any number of reasons why they didn't. I know that, for example, within my stakeholder group, it was just difficult to convince people that this was a subject that they had a position on, and therefore that it seemed to just not get the impetus. Whether that, therefore, would be represented in them being willing to even give over part of their precious time for constituency day to this, but it's certainly worth looking at. I guess I've always had the same question. I don't see any other hands at the moment. I've always had the same question, I think, about why have a public meeting at this point? Do we have anything to present? If it's just to ask questions that some people have answered and many people haven't, what expectation do we have that people would come and that it would be a worthwhile experience? So that was sort of always my view on that, and the notion of having an open meeting of the group where obviously anyone was allowed to come, sit at the table, speak, participate, and such could be a way to get greater interest. I guess one of the things Marika had suggested was that it would also be possible in such a meeting to have both a work group and a public meeting, but I wasn't quite sure how that would work in terms of room arrangements, in that are you in a small enough room, are you in a big room, how that would work. Simonette, I see your hand up again, and I see Marika has her hand up.
Well, I mean, one way we could go about this is to actually proactively, like, reach out to certain people and invite them to come to this meeting in person rather than just putting it on the agenda and hoping that they read it and understand what we're trying to achieve there. Maybe that could be a way to go about making good use of that quick presentation of maybe what is it even that this work group is really looking at, because I'm not sure how much time people think to just basically read up on what other work groups are doing and what's really behind the issues and the charter questions we're currently exploring, because it's not necessarily completely apparent. If you just read that and you glance over it, I'm not sure you really understand what we're trying to look at. So if we could maybe do a quick presentation of what it is that we're trying to explore and then bring those questions back up again and invite for further input, but make sure that we personally invited some of the folks we want to hear from, maybe that could be a way to get to make the most out of an hour of time at that meeting.
Before going to Marika, can I ask a clarifying question of you? Is this in terms of a larger workshop meeting you're speaking, or in terms of a face-to-face working group meeting that you're speaking of?
I'm not sure.
Okay, thanks. Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. Based on past experience, IRTP is not typically a topic that draws huge crowds to the meeting. I mean, we've had various workshops or open meetings, and usually, you know, it's the same people that show up that have either participated in the work on previous occasions, or people that have been specifically targeted. So I think for a room, space-wise, I don't think it will be a big issue if the meetings will be combined, because the working group is not that large as such, and there's always room for additional people to join. I think usually those meetings are in the same room that the GNSO has its meetings in over the weekend. So the space has never been an issue before for any of the IRTP meetings, as far as I recall. I think what Simonetta was suggesting has been done in some of previous working groups, where indeed there would be, for example, a two-hour block or an hour-and-a-half block, where the first part would be dedicated just to the face-to-face meeting of the working group, and then the second part would be kicked off by indeed a little kind of overview of, this is what the group is looking at, these are the issues that we're dealing with, these are some of the specific questions we have, and then basically open that up for people that have come to attend that meeting. I think if the working group would decide on such an approach, it's just very important to communicate that clearly on the schedule, to really make clear that, that first 45 minutes is for the working group itself to, go through the issues or whatever is on the agenda, and that at X time, that's when the open part of the meeting starts. In such a way, it would also allow, if it turns out that only, a few people show up or there are just very little questions for the group, the group could then decide just to take that extra time and continue its normal deliberations and work through its agenda. So that allows for some flexibility as well, because, at this stage, I guess it's not really clear whether we have anything ready to share with the broader community for feedback, or whether it's more of an update and, is there anything you would like to contribute to what we're doing so far. So,
great. thanks. I see Michaela's hand is up. Yes, Michaela.
I mean, basically what Marika described there, I mean, that's what we did in IRTPB a couple of times. I mean, we had a kind of a meeting of the group, and then a kind of open to the floor, anybody who wants to pitch in with thoughts, questions, or whatever could do so. But I also think it's very important to actually try to explain to people what the hell we're doing, because acronyms like IRTP don't mean a lot to anybody. And once you start getting into the detail that we unfortunately have to get into, most people get lost by the wayside fairly quickly. Thanks.
Okay, thanks. Michaela, have those meetings been successful? I'm assuming they have been for both you and Marika to be recommending that. So, and I don't remember attending them. So have they worked successfully? Has it worked successfully, for example, to put the meeting before the open part? Should the open part go before the meeting part? Did you do handouts with the acronym?
I mean, the problem, Avery, is a very, very simple one. During an ICANN meeting, there are a lot of things going on. So if, for example, you end up with IRTP going right up against Rob Beckstrom and co. Holding a press conference because they've just made some announcement, then, you know, your attendance is going to be impacted. And we've had that happen in the past, where I can't remember if it was IRTPB or whether it was Pedner or one of the other ones, we ended up where we were straight up against, I think it was the conflict of interest meeting, which of course a lot of people wanted to go to. I mean, the thing is this, is that if we can try to encourage as many people to go to it as possible, you know, in other words, we're facilitating that feedback from the community, because without the feedback from the community, we can't understand whether people, you know, really care about this, or is it just a couple of us who actually give a damn, then, you know, it makes it very, very hard. But, you know, the other thing as well is that you shouldn't assume that there's going to be loads of people who are going to turn up. You might end up in a situation where you have your working group members and the rest of the people sitting on the chairs are ICANN staff. So you just have to work from that, you know, the basis that you could just end up where it's just a short working meeting where maybe you can go through a few things, and, you know, if there's nobody there, well, I mean, so what? You cut it short. I mean, that's fine. But at least you were there for people if they didn't turn up. It's not, you know, you can, I don't know what this, I'm trying to think of the analogy. I mean, you can bring a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. I don't know what the analogy is about meetings, but, you know, the idea being you can give people the opportunity to go to a meeting. You can't force them kicking and screaming to attend.
You can't even make them listen. Okay, I want to try and bring this to a close. I've got Sima Mehta, and then I think I'll try and sum it up where we're at. Sima Mehta.
I'm just wondering if we could quickly come up with kind of like a short list of people whose input we would want to seek, and then really make it a point to ask them to come.
Okay.
Because I have a feeling that we didn't get a ton of feedback, period, and I really would want to make sure that if there is something that people actually care about, once they really understand what it is that we're working on, that we're getting their input early and not after working through a whole cycle of more meetings until we are in Prague, and then people start to understand, and out of a sudden the discussion takes a completely different spin with information that if we had thought out that feedback earlier, we could have incorporated earlier as well and then be done quicker with our work.
Okay, thank you. Marika.
Yeah, it doesn't really, just one last point I wanted to make is that, you know, by the 3rd of February, the only thing I really need to know at that stage is basically, you know, is there a preference for a time, day to meet, and how long the meeting should be so I can fill in my request. With regard to the agenda, the working group will have a bit more time to think about it. And, you know, if you indeed decide to have one meeting but, you know, are still struggling on how to divide that up, I think there's some more time and it can be done closer to the meeting. Because what we typically do these days, especially for working groups, is it's really hard by, you know, the 3rd of February to decide what you'll be doing in the meeting in March, because it all depends as well on how much progress is being made, you know, in the time in between. What we usually do is just create a wiki page and include that in the agenda or in the schedule as where to people can find more information. So what I need to know about the 3rd of February is indeed the number of people you expect, the time, and if there's a preference for a date, you know, noting that there's no guarantee if that will be given because it depends on a lot of other factors as well. But that would give the working group a bit more time to really think about the structure of the meeting and as well, indeed, to obviously be approached or invited to attend. And so that gives a bit more time to think about that and you know, have let weigh in what has been done in the meantime and making progress on the issues and then what there is to share with the community.
Okay, thanks. Well, listening, and I want to close this one, listening to the discussion and reading what went on in the chat, I think it's fairly clear that we are looking at this hybrid meeting. I heard no one speak to the to the regular workshop. It wasn't covered exactly, but I would think that it would tend to want to be after the constituency stakeholder, so the Wednesday or the Thursday. And I think Bob should write this up and send it out to the list just to see that it makes sense. That people have talked about it being a 90-minute block. We can go later into the, how it's subdivided. I think the outreach point was made a couple times. That outreach could be done personally by people. We also had the idea mentioned of perhaps visiting stakeholder groups and constituency meetings for brief discussions to fill them in a little on what the issues are to try and pull the interest to see that if there is something, it's been brought in. So it looks like we're nearing a view on it. Does anyone object to that view? Does that view seem to be what other people think it is that we sort of reached a nearing consensus on? In which case, I'd say move on with that. Probably it's worth one of us writing it up on the list just to make sure that of the people that didn't attend this meeting, though we do have sort of an attendance requested type of meeting just to make sure that there isn't an issue. But I think that sort of is as far as we need to get at the moment. Any last comments on that before I move on? Last question. Okay, not seeing any. Then the next part is the review of the public comments. There's the reference to the public comment tool. I saw, that there was only one public comment, and there was a synthesis of it, and I don't know anything yet about, other than what was mentioned at the last meeting, about how many stakeholder group or constituencies and whether we had more than one. Marika, would you like to introduce us into this discussion?
Yes, so this is Marika. So what you see up on the screen is the public comments review tool, and what I've done is basically taken the different comments that were submitted. So as I said, there was one comment to the public comment forum from GoDaddy, and there was one stakeholder group statement received so far from the registry stakeholder group. So those are reflected here in this overview. What I've done is basically broken the different comments down along the lines of the charter questions, so that's hopefully easier for the working group to review the different comments. So the idea would be that the working group goes through each of these comments, formulates a response in relation to the comment, and also decides whether there's a recommended action based on that comment, noting that in some cases there might not be a recommended action, or working group response might be as well, that a certain comment is noted. So that's basically how it has been set up. I don't know if we're still getting other comments. I did reach out to some of the other groups, but at this stage I'm not aware of any other comments being forthcoming, but it will be easy to add them to the review tool as needed. Do you just want me to start with comment one?
Unless somebody thinks otherwise, I would think that doing a first walkthrough of the comments and then going back to the discussion of comment by comment, but just to make sure that we sort of got a complete picture to start. If that makes sense to you.
Yeah, that's fine. As James can't speak, I'm happy to cover the GoDaddy comments, but I don't know if Barbara maybe wants to cover the registry ones, or do you prefer me to go through all of them?
I think it's up to the person. If the person would prefer doing it, it's fine. But as you did the synthesis of them, it might be just as easy for the first, you know, introduction to be the sort of neutral synthesis and then follow up.
Okay, I'll just kick it off then, and I'm sure someone will intervene if they don't agree with my summary. So the first comment is from GoDaddy, and basically notes that transferring domain name registration between registrants is inconsistently handled by registrars and other service providers, and it therefore recommends that the working group should seek to strike a balance between domain name security and domain name portability. And this specifically relates to charter question A. Then the second comment is from the registry stakeholder group, and they express their support for conducting a more detailed study of the best practices used by the various country code TLD operators. The registry stakeholder group in its third comment is also supportive of the working group recommending that appropriate best practices be implemented by GTLDs in this area. And they also acknowledge that since registrars own the relationship with the registrant and the change of control is directly related to the registrant, only the registrar should actually be permitted to effect a change of control. And they highlight that this should also be the case in relation to UDRP directives. Following comment also comes from the registry stakeholder group. With regard to reason for denial number 8, many registries have a systematic restriction on the transfer of domain names within 60 days of the creation date. And as a result of that, it's the view of the registry stakeholder group that measures are already in place to reduce fraud in the early days of the domain name's existence. And no further clarification is therefore needed to this specific reason for denial. The registry stakeholder group know that in relation to reason for denial number 9, since some transfer disputes are raised as a result of the registrar's practice of locking down a domain when modifications are made to the registrant details, the registry stakeholder group recommends that additional clarification be added to specifically state that registrars are prohibited from restricting transfers for 60 days after changes to the registrant details. And to the extent that a new policy is developed to address the change of control function, that policy could also address any specific restrictions or impacts that a change of registrant details would have on inter-registrar transfers.
Okay, thanks. What I wanted to do now is take a pause and ask if there are any either clarifications or questions about what was posted. Not getting into the discussion yet, but so much just making sure that what's there is clear and clarified and questioned. So does anybody have anything? I see nothing. Okay, then moving on to question B.
This is Marika again. So in relation to charter question B, comment 6 from GoDaddy, practical limits on the effective term of a form of authorization should be considered. GoDaddy suggests that 60 days would be a reasonable time frame, and to form its work, the IRTP Part C working group should gather and consider scenarios in which a registrar receives an FOA from the registrant but does not submit the transfer request to the registry. The registry stakeholder group notes that support for the concept of time limiting the FOA, but it defers to the registrar community to determine what a reasonable time limit should be for that.
Okay, thank you. On any questions or clarifications on that? If there aren't, I have a question on the comment from the registry stakeholder group. Okay, and I see Rob Golding has one, so I'll defer mine until after Rob goes. Please, Rob.
I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Okay.
Actually, it was just regarding point 5. I was just making sure that what was read out and what was typed up was exactly what was said. It says that the registry stakeholder group recommends that additional clarification be added to specifically state that registrars are prohibited from restricting transfers for 60 days after changes. Now, unfortunately, some registries are locking the domains after updates to the domain. And also, wasn't the policy or something to do with the IRTP B where we said that after a change of registered name holder, we should try and stop transfers for at least a certain period of time in order to maintain a definite change of control versus change of admin contact to transfer it away. So was the comment number five specifically state registrars are prohibited from restricting transfers correct?
Thank you. Michaela, is your hand raised as a response?
Yes.
Please.
I mean, following up on Rob's query there, I mean, first of all, as Rob said, I mean, under the current policy, we as registrars have the option. We don't have to, but, I mean, one of our recommendations from B was that it would become an obligation that following a transfer between registrars, in other words, an intra-registrar transfer, at the moment we have the option to stop a domain from being transferred to another registrar. Several of the CCTLDs have certain checks and balances in place when there is a substantive change to a registrant. So if you start tickering around with what the registrant details, well, in many cases you actually can't. I mean, you can only make certain changes. You can't make the really big changes. And ultimately, as far as end users are concerned, whether the domain is a .eu or a .com or a .us, they don't really care. It's a domain, and they might be using it for their business or they might be using it for their personal whatever. You know, trying to confusing people further because there are subtle but unnecessary differences in policies doesn't really help anybody. The other thing as well is that when you have registrars of a certain size where they control a significant market share, an internal transfer is in many respects almost identical as far as users are concerned to a transfer between registrars. You know, so I think, you know, it's something that needs to be discussed and looked at much more closely. And I would have serious concerns about the registry stakeholder group comments on this matter.
Thank you, Barbara.
Okay, this is Barbara. So basically, the question that has come up, and from our perspective, we were looking at it as a registrar to registrar or inter-registrar transfer, not an internal transfer, if you will. To the extent that you know, the registrars are fine with that, then we wouldn't have an issue with it. But I will say that, you know, we do get complaints at the registries relative to a registrant making a change to, you know, maybe some non-material data points on their who is, and as a result of that, the registrar does lock the name down. So it's been a little bit vague, the feedback that we've gotten, even at the second level, domain dispute resolution, is that the intent was that registrars would be prohibited from restricting transfers, that they could not deny a transfer as a result of registrant detail changes. And so that's basically what we were looking for. Now, to the extent that everybody is comfortable with people making changes, then, you know, we obviously will honor whatever is decided. But I do think that there are some points for clarification that need to be made here, because it doesn't specifically state it, but in practice, that seems to be what the intent has been. Because when we've had to, you know, send these on to a second-level dispute resolution provider, you know, they've ruled that registrars are not permitted to restrict a transfer based on a change of registrant detail.
Thank you. Simonetta, was your comment still on five? My comment
Yes.
is on seven, so if yours is on five, I'd say you should go before me.
Okay. This is Simonetta. So my reaction to this is it looks like there is obviously disagreement about a statement, and it might be helpful also for our meeting in Costa Rica if we could find some of those reasons why people are saying these things. So I hear Barbara saying that registries dislike the fact that they're having to deal with the complaints as a result of certain registrars locking down a domain name. Now, there's probably a reason why a registrar wants to do this, and then it would be helpful to understand why a registrar is trying to do this so we can kind of weigh the reasons for why this is happening and and find out what a reasonable approach should be, and obviously maybe also seek some input from the people that are affected by that, mainly the registrants, and kind of like hear some of the upside and or frustrations they have with the current approach so that the booking group has a better foundation to discuss a question like this.
Okay, thank you. I think the only comment I would make on that one is I don't know that we need to wait for Costa Rica for that discussion. I think once we go into the discussions on charter question A, you know, we may get there. But you're right, that is a good thing to put on the question. On a personal hat, and it's not a co-chair hat, on 7, I guess one issue that occurred to me, and perhaps this is a non-contracted party knee-jerk reaction to deferring to the registrar community to determine a reasonable time limit for the FOA, and just sort of would want to comment that I would think that it could defer to the the working group, the community at large, and that length of an FOA, insofar as it does affect registrant ability to do things, becomes a place where we not only defer to the registrar community, but that it basically includes more than just their concerns in terms of that deferral. Yes, Michele.
I'm afraid I have to disagree with you. I mean, the thing is this, is that, you know, policy development should be based on facts and everything else. However, you know, both the registries and the registrars are the ones who deal with the FOAs. Registrants have actually little or no visibility of them, and wouldn't need to have any visibility on them. I mean, if you want to get feedback from the community, get feedback in general terms, but when it comes down to FOAs, I wouldn't see how a lot of the community are qualified to make any real substantive input into this. And I can actually see it leading to more confusion rather than anything else. Sorry.
Okay, thank you. Simonetta.
Kind of have to disagree with you there, Michele. I think there's two types of users. I think you are correct for the person who never, or who doesn't do a lot with their domain names. They might not know what an FOA even is, and they are completely confused by the current process in any way. But there is a large number of people who frequently deal with transfers and owner updates at the same time, and they are very aware of the consequences of time limit would have on an FOA and the pros and cons of an approach like that. So it would definitely be interesting to seek the feedback of those people that deal with this on a day-to-day basis.
Okay, thank you. Mikey.
This is Mikey. Simonetta stole everything I was going to say, so I'll just say like she said.
Okay, thank you. I always love that kind of answer. And Bob.
Yeah, I'm exactly where Mikey was. I was going to make the same point, so I'll just support Simonetta's comment.
Okay, thank you. So obviously there's a further discussion to be had on 7 as we move forward. Any other comments on the charter question B comments? If not, Marika, back to you for C.
Yes, so this is Marika, comment 8 from GoDaddy relating to charter question C. GoDaddy anticipates that this might become a greater burden for all registrars when new GTLDs, when hundreds of new GTLDs are active in the DNS, move to uniformly employ IANA ID numbers in GTLD registry systems would therefore be favored to the extent practical. And then the comment number 9 from the registry stakeholder group, it is generally agreed that registrar name changes often do make it difficult to ensure that the correct registrar is identified, and use of the IANA ID may be helpful in confirming registrar identification. They also know that it is reasonable to think that all registries do maintain the IANA ID for each registrar in their registration systems.
Okay. Any comments on questions, clarifications on 8 and 9? Okay. And then moving on to the next block.
Yes, so this is Marika. So the next blocks basically relate to the specific additional questions that we asked in our in the template that we provided to the constituencies and stakeholder groups. So the first one relates to frequency of hijacking cases. So the registries know that registries do not have a comprehensive view of hijacking cases, as very few cases ever reach the registries for action. It is agreed that data relating to the frequency of hijacking instances is critical to understanding the extent of the issue. The registry stakeholder group is hopeful that registrars may be able to propose a mechanism by which to gather and provide information in a manner that will protect the proprietary nature of the data.
Any comments? Clarifications? Questions? Okay, I see a message. I have not been following the chat very well. I see there were several comments on earlier ones. Just to note that GoDaddy did not respond to these. Did that mean that GoDaddy did intend to follow up with a response, or just I see some typing and we can get back to it. No. Okay. So it's not that we're expecting something. Okay. So I see no hands up on wanting to further comment, clarify, or question. Going to 11, it's again, that one's a quickie. It's another defers to registrar community for feedback on the change of control issue. Let you read it. So I guess I don't understand this one. It's basically on the question of the CCTLD feedback and similar procedures, deferring to the registrar community on an interest in their other practices. I guess I don't quite understand the comment from the registries that if the registrar community is not interested in the CCTLD feedback, then we shouldn't get it. Yes, Barbara.
Okay, this is Barbara. So basically, because it's the registrars that own that relationship and the change of control function for a registrant, you know, we would basically defer to, you know, the registrar community and what they would see as appropriate, perhaps, best practices to put forward based on what the CCTLDs are doing.
Okay, thank you. If I can raise my hand, I guess. Once again, ask the same question I was asking, in that all of these practices that have effects on the registrant, that to some extent, whatever practice, so wouldn't it also be worth knowing what effect the various CCTLD's practices on change of control had on their registrant? And how did that play out? And so, again, I guess I would think, and this is probably a comment of mine on almost every issue where the registries defer to their partners in the contracted house, that these issues do go further and have registrant effects that also need to be taken into account. And Michaela, it's yours.
Yeah, but Avery, this is the thing where, you know, look, you've got to recognize that we're the ones who are dealing with the customer service issues that either the lack of clear policies and processes has, and, you know, the impact when there is a clear policy and a process. So, I mean, the thing is this, the reason why it makes sense on many levels for us to be the ones to actually give some feedback is we know what our customer service staff run into in terms of problems, because we're seeing a large number of complaints about a particular way of doing things, or we don't have any complaints about a particular way of doing things. I mean, the problem when you throw this back to the supposed community, which I still think is a terrible misnomer in many respects, is that you're going to get back feedback from a very, very small, narrow group of people who are basically domain investors who have a significantly vested interest in domain names, and they're not ordinary registrants. which actually ends up kind of defeating the purpose of what you might have originally intended. It'd be more interesting if you could actually get feedback from, I don't know, from ALAC in general. That would be useful, because supposedly ALAC represent the kind of normal end user. But I'm very wary of this kind of general feedback thing, because you'll end up getting feedback from some domainer who has invested millions of dollars in domain names and who likes to be able to flip them quickly and easily. It's not the same as getting the feedback from your average registrant who makes up the bulk of domain names that are actively registered. And the thing is that the average registrant doesn't really care as long as the damn thing works. Thanks.
Okay, thanks. This is Aubrey's personal comment again. I certainly did not mean to say that the registrar's viewpoint shouldn't be gathered. And I think you make a really good point about reaching further than just the commercial non-contracted parties to the non-commercial non-contracted parties and indeed to the user community. And I think that I totally accept that as an extension in terms of not just deferring to the registrar community, but deferring to the larger user and registrant base, both commercial and non-commercial. I think, you know, certainly just getting the view of one kind of registrant was not at all my intent, but was basically saying there might be a wider set of people, users, and registrants whose opinions do need to be gathered. Thanks. Simonetta.
Here, Michele, and I think he has a very good point in that it is a lot harder to solicit feedback from someone who might not be a professional domain investor. But I think it would be worthwhile trying, and maybe we would have to spend a little bit of time thinking about how we would get that type of feedback and maybe set up a survey that could be sent out to people who have just transferred a domain name or do something like that and filter for people who don't own a lot of names but only own very few names. I think it would be worthwhile trying to get their feedback. If we can't get it, that's another story. But I think that's ultimately the people who will make use of this policy is the people who will try to get a name from A to B, whether or not this is a professional investor or someone who is just for the very first time picking a name for their website and happens to pick one that is owned by someone else. So I think it would be worthwhile trying to get their feedback, although I agree with you that it's hard to get.
Okay, thank you. Mikey?
This is Mikey. I think one other thing that I'd like to raise is, and this is mostly directed to Barbara, I think we probably want to be interested in feedback from the registries too. I think, especially in the CC world, the roles of registries vary quite a bit, and I think that it would be good to not let them off the hook quite so readily. I understand the notion of deferring, but I want to hear from them because I think they have an important perspective on all this.
Okay, thank you. Barbara?
Hi, this is Barbara. Mikey, by no means are we saying we don't want to participate at all, but, you know, again, the registrars do own that relationship. So, you know, I think we do need to rely on, you know, as Michele said, the feedback that they get from their customers. I mean, they are their registrants. They get that feedback. So, you know, while I appreciate, yes, we should open this up and a lot of people should have input and feedback into it, you know, I think that we really do need to rely on, you know, the registrars to kind of put the voice of their customers forward when they're trying to figure out what is going to be a viable solution for, you know, changing a change of control or change of registrant data on a domain name. You know, as far as we as the registries are concerned, yes, we will definitely participate in the conversations and bring forward, you know, any experiences that we've had and you know, we're happy to participate in that. But I do think that, you know, more weight probably should go to the registrar community on these.
Okay, thank you. Mikey?
Just to respond to Barbara, I don't disagree with any of that, but I think that the conversation's headed in the right direction. Absolutely don't want to ignore the registrars. Don't want to get McKaylee mad at me. Hell, that's a big lose-lose deal. But at the same time, I think that there are a lot of voices that are useful to hear, much along the lines of what the point that Avery made about the broader community. And so I just don't want to lose the opportunity to get as many smart people in this conversation as possible. That's all.
Okay, thank you. Michaela?
Are we talking about GTLDs or CCTLDs when we're talking about registries? Because this is I think, where there's a little bit of confusion. I think when Barbara's speaking, you have to remember, she's speaking from the perspective of a GTLD registry within a group of GTLD registries who have purely financial arrangements with registrars. Whereas when you're looking at the CCNSO and the CCTLDs, who in many cases have this nailed and have lots of experience doing it, the entire relationship is completely different. Like, I, as an individual, and forget about what I do for my day job, I cannot go to VeriSign's website and register a .com domain name with VeriSign. I can't do that. I can, however, do that if I go to a lot of the CCTLD registries. And, you know, this, the CCNSO members have a lot of experience of various types of activities, which, oh my God, also happen to impact people in GTLDs, and there's going to be more and more of this cross-pollination between the two groups as things move forward. Because, you know, if you want to avoid SOPA, just as a silly example, then you can go off and move your domains into .eus or some random CCTLD, theoretically at least. But, you know, the point I'm trying to get at is that, you know, I think, you know, the one of the problems I've seen is where in the GNSO, people tend to forget about the CCNSO, and the CCNSO has a huge amount of experience, and they've covered and thought about things a lot, and it's because their structures and everything else and the way they do things are so completely different. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. I think there's good stuff that we're going to come back and discuss here, so I won't add anything at this point. Can we go through 12 and 13 just to make sure that we've finished the read-through for today? Marika?
Yep. So this is Marika. Based to charter question B and C, where we also requested further data, the registry stakeholder group here also defers to the registrar community for feedback relating to charter questions B, since the registry stakeholder group has little to no information relating to the age of FOAs used in the transfer of domain names from one registrar to another. And comment 13, that relates to charter question C, where registries and registrars were asked to provide specific information as to where proprietary IDs are currently being used. And the response of the registry stakeholder group was there that at least two registries have been identified as using proprietary IDs instead of the IANA assigned IDs. In the case of at least one of these registries, proprietary IDs are used in all registrar communications. The primary driver behind the use of proprietary IDs versus IANA IDs is security. The registries that currently use proprietary IDs have indicated that the use of proprietary IDs aids in the prevention of mining of WHOIS data based on publicly available IANA IDs. There would need to be a compelling reason for these registries to transition to the use of IANA IDs, as the level of effort involved would be significant given that all systems would be impacted.
Okay, thank you. Barbara?
Hi, this is Barbara, and I actually had some further feedback that I had received from some of those registry operators that are currently using proprietary IDs. One of the other things that they had pointed out as the reason behind why they're doing that is because, you know, obviously they're dealing with a lot of registrars, if you will, that may also be selling CCTLDs. And so from a consistency perspective, you know, CCTLD registrars are not required to be ICANN accredited, so they would not have an assigned IANA ID. So from their perspective, they're using these internal proprietary IDs so that they can identify the registrars across the board in their systems using the same ID, since in all cases, as I said, some of the CCTLD registrars are not necessarily ICANN accredited with an ICANN accredited or an assigned IN ID. So that was some additional feedback that I had received actually after we had prepared these particular statements.
Okay. Michaela, I'll give you the last word before I close up the discussion for today's meeting, and then I'll take a couple minutes just to wrap up. Please, Michaela.
Woohoo, I get a last word. How
well,
that stings.
I talk after you.
Oh, so it's not a last word. God, you're no fun, Avery. Now, just coming back to you on this point, Barbara, I mean, the thing is, like, fine, explaining how and why they ended up doing what they're doing is fine and wonderful, and it's helpful to a certain degree. But the point is that while, okay, in the case of Afilias, who I would presume is the entity who actually gave that feedback, since they're about the only one I can think of who would be able to, if they want to have their own, let's say, for example, if an ID is, let's say, 8 characters long, if they want to use 4 characters for the IAN ID plus 4 characters for some internal thing, let them. Because then it's as long as we know which part of it is the IAN ID, that's grand. And then they can have the other 4 characters for themselves. I mean, the thing is that registries are perfectly happy to change how things are generated when it suits them. And if their contract allows them to do that without having to consult registrars, they'll happily do it. So, you know, the shoe's on the other foot.
Okay. Thank you. I think we had a good first talk through on this. I think there's obviously a couple issues where further discussion on the comments and further. I would also like to recommend that any of the folks on this call who come from stakeholder groups and constituencies such as me who did not have comments take this synthesis back to their respective groups and see if they do have some at least second-order comments to make that can be brought by those people into the conversation at the next meeting. So I'd like to recommend that at the next meeting, when we will have our regular host back running the meeting, that we sort of go back through the issues, find out the places where there are either issues of further discussion and work to be done, perhaps coming up with techniques for finding ways to collect further information, clarifying any differences that have come up, and we basically take the next step. We may be able to finish on the comments in the next period. Hopefully we'll get some of the comments from our advisory committees, et cetera, who have not yet submitted comments that we can also go through. With that, I thank everybody for the meeting. I thank you for putting up with me as chair, and we'll have the meeting same time, same details, I assume, next week. Thank you, Marika, also for the work done to put this into the public comments review tool. I love this tool. I think it's great. Thank you all.
Thank you, Aubrey.
Thank you, Aubrey. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Aubrey.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Sam. You can now stop the recordings. Thanks.
Thank you.